Palestinian officials in Gaza say Israel has destroyed over 1,000 mosques across the territory as the death toll from the regime's genocide tops 25,000. Palestinian resistance fighters carry out retaliatory strikes against Israeli forces in Gaza, destroying their vehicles and killing invading troops. And Yemen once again warns against any aggression and violation of its sovereignty amid the country's anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea. Thank you for joining us. Now Israel presses ahead with its bombing campaign across or against Gaza, killing more Palestinians in its fresh strikes on the besieged strip. The regime's warplanes rained down bombs on a number of residential buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis. As a result, a dozen civilians, including three children, lost their lives. Also in Khan Yunis, Israel once again bombed and shelled the vicinity of Nasser Hospital. That's one of multiple medical facilities frequently struck by the regime since the beginning of its onslaught. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, Israel deliberately targets hospitals. Religious places are not safe from the bombing campaign either. The Ministry of Endowments and Religious Affairs in Gaza says over 1,000 mosques and several churches, including a Greek Orthodox church, have been destroyed so far. The overall death toll from Israel's non-stop attacks on the coastal territory has topped 25,000, most of them women and kids. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released a video showing the latest losses its fighters have inflicted on Israeli forces in Gaza. The fighters of the Al-Qassam brigades targeted invading Israeli forces who had gathered inside the building. They also hit an armored vehicle parked outside. The video also shows a military bulldozer belonging to the regime's troops being struck with an RPG shell. Palestinian fighters have been putting stiff resistance to invading troops and carrying out retaliatory attacks on the ground in Gaza. Scores of Israeli troops have been killed since the regime launched its ground invasion of Gaza in November. The resistance groups believe the Israeli military is hiding the real number of fatalities amongst enforcers. A senior Yemeni official says the country will not allow any violation of its sovereignty and confront any acts of aggression it faces. Mohammed Abdel Salam also urged the United States not to evade its responsibility for ending the Israeli aggression against Gaza. He called on all countries to support Yemen's stance and not to fall victim to Washington's deception. The official added, Yemen reaffirms its backing for the Palestinian people by exerting pressure on Israel to stop its crimes in Gaza. He reiterated that Yemen only targets Israeli ships or the ones bound for ports in the occupied Palestinian territories. At least one member of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has been killed in an Israeli drone attack in the southern Lebanese village of Kafra. A high-ranking Hezbollah official has survived the strike. Our correspondent Maryam Saleh tells us more.
Definitely there was a martyr for Hezbollah in that vehicle. Also, sources have told us that a high-ranking commander seems to have survived an attempt, an assassination attempt, since this is one of the cars that is used by his security. And as a result of this drone attack, there was another civilian car that was hit. And we have, of course, at least seven people who are wounded. One of them is a woman, a civilian woman, who was wounded severely. But we do have a martyr, and the martyr is said to be one of the members of Hezbollah. And this is at least the third drone attack that we have where a high-ranking Hezbollah commander was actually the aim of the Israelis in the targeting. And Hezbollah seems to have been able to stave off, of course, this attempt by the Israelis. The Israelis have, since the assassination of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, begun with what seems to be a new policy, and that is a policy of assassinations, a specific drone attacks, since the attack also took place in the area of Kafra. And here we're talking a place which is relatively far away from the border. It is in South Lebanon, but it is further off from the border. But this also comes as Hezbollah has made it very clear that they will also target soldiers in all the Israeli posts.
A member of the Israeli Knesset says those who oppose Tel Aviv's military campaign against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip receive death threats. Ofer Kassif said Israel suppresses the freedom of speech of those who raise their voice against the regime's war on Gaza. He added that the people are also being detained for their tweets and other online posts calling for an end to the conflict. According to the legislator, university students are suspended, people are fired from their jobs, and demonstrators are brutally repressed simply because they demand an end to the Israeli war on Gaza. Kassif was suspended from the Knesset for 45 days for criticizing the Israeli onslaught, which began on October the 7th. Political experts are increasingly questioning the United States' qualification as a mediator in the ongoing war between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli regime. This after the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson reiterated opposition to any ceasefire in Israel's ongoing onslaught against the coastal territory. During his latest presser, John Kirby rejected any prospects of an end to Israel's brutal aggression on Gaza, claiming a ceasefire will benefit no one but the Hamas resistance group. His remarks came amid growing international call for the Gaza ceasefire and an outcry over Israel's unprecedented crimes there. Meanwhile, the United States has been trying to promote the idea of a two-state solution to deal with the crisis, posing itself as a mediator. Washington's rejection of the prospect of a ceasefire is in addition to its veto of several UN resolutions on ending the war. Political experts, as well as millions of people around the world, believe that the U.S. has no respect for the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians, including over 1 million kids living in Gaza. Earlier today, we spoke to Firwaza Najim, the manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights from Toronto. He told us that the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq are a clear message that if Washington wants to continue its support for the ongoing genocide in Gaza, its assets and soldiers will not remain safe in the region.
I mean, this is a very special development now in this recent battle where many other resistance groups are getting involved to help the people of Gaza and be able to slap this regime from different corners. Obviously, the U.S. is the one that's behind fueling and supporting this genocide. You know, we've seen that with the vetoes inside the United Nations and by supplying the weapons and, you know, media backing and so on. So I think that this is going to put some pressure. I don't know how much pressure, but it is putting a lot of pressure, and the U.S. is feeling it because, you know, they're losing soldiers. Their soldiers are being wounded. Their bases are being shaken by the resistance, the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. America is not allowed to have and host bases inside of Iraq, and we've seen that also, you know, with elected members inside the Parliament of Iraq after they killed Qasem Soleimani and the great general Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the two main generals that destroyed ISIS. You know, they were the majority voted for the U.S. troops to leave Iraq. They're illegitimate. They're not supposed to be there, and they're forcing themselves on the Iraqi soil. And obviously, you know, it's not for the interest of Iraq, it's for the interest of Israel, it's for the interest of the puppet regimes that have been installed in West Asia and the Middle East.
People in the Syrian capital, Damascus, have held a funeral for the Iranian military advisors who were martyred in an Israeli terror strike. Our correspondent Ibrahim Wadi has this report.
A solemn funeral procession has been held at the Sayyida Ruqayya Shrine in the heart of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The procession was held for the five Iranian military advisors who were martyred in an Israeli attack on the residential neighborhood of Mazze. Many people attended the funeral, including religious figures and pilgrims from various countries who affirmed that martyrdom paves the way to victory over the enemies.
The path of martyrdom will culminate in victory, despite the enemy's will. We will emerge triumphant, forcing the enemy out of our land. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood will sweep the enemy away. Through solidarity in the resistance front, from Islamic Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and the heroic Houthis in Yemen, along with our Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance.
We came to visit the shrine of Sayyida Ruqayya and attended the funeral of Iranian and Syrian martyrs. We are all united as witnesses from southern Lebanon to Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and we will not fear or weaken, no matter the sacrifices.
With great pride, honor, and faith in martyrdom, the funeral procession arrived at the Sayyida Zainab shrine, peace be upon her, for prayers over the martyrs' bodies. Participants emphasized that the enemy's atrocities cannot intimidate them or deter them from continuing on the path of resistance until victory is achieved with the blessing of the martyrs' blood. Iran's charged affairs affirmed that there will be a response to the Israeli crime.
Once again, the Zionist entity, through its aggression, violates Syrian sovereignty and targets a building housing Iranian advisors in Damascus. Today, as we participate in the funeral ceremonies of these great martyrs, we affirm to the Zionist entity that this crime will not go unpunished. As the Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated, we will not forget our martyrs, and the Zionist entity will face retaliation from the axis of resistance.
These are sacrifices made by the heroes of the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, as well as the resistance in Syria and Iran. These are martyrs who give their lives for the resistance front. This is the path of our martyrs and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. This aggression exposes the enemy's setbacks in Syria and in Gaza, which has driven them to commit these crimes.
The mourners carried the coffins of the martyrs with a mix of sadness and anger, chanting slogans demanding revenge and punishment. They affirmed their readiness to go all the way on the path of liberating Al-Quds and all occupied territories, no matter how great the sacrifices may be. They expressed confidence in the capabilities of the axis of resistance and the wisdom of its leadership. Once again, Syrian and Iranian blood mixed to water the land of Damascus as a result of an Israeli criminal attack. And once again, we see Syrians and Iranians united more than ever and determined to defeat the Zionist regime. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Iran's Red Crescent Society has hosted a conference in Tehran in support of Gaza. Representatives of different relief organizations operating in conflict zones were present. Amongst many crucial steps, they decided to establish a joint humanitarian aid fund for the Palestinians under Israeli attack. Yusumish Ahmadi has more.
The world's largest humanitarian network mobilized to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza under incessant Israeli attacks. Iran's Red Crescent Society, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies, and a number of other international organizations are now joining hands to provide assistance and deliver aid shipments to Gaza, a process that has been hindered over the past 3 months due to the Zionist regime's total disrespect for any kind of international law, including the Geneva Conventions.
The main obstacle we are facing right now for the aid in Gaza is the lack of respect of international humanitarian law, the law that is the law during war. And this law has to be respected by all the parties in this conflict, and this we do not see on the ground. Secondly, we need, of course, access. We need better and more reliable, sustained access into Gaza and within Gaza. In order, that's the third point, to increase and scale up humanitarian assistance to the Strip. Right now, it's by far not sufficient what can go into the Strip for this population that is in desperate need of all the items. We need more crossing point, we need regular supply lines, and we need a procedure that allows humanitarian assistance at scale.
Over 24 delegates representing regional divisions of relief organizations operating in conflict zones such as Doctors Without Borders and UNICEF, as well as the ICRC and IRCS, took part in the conference, hoping to find practical measures to help the people of Gaza.
The most important thing is the humanitarian diplomacy, because nothing in the world is more effective than people sitting down and discussing and talking and to come to solutions in which the affected people can find assistance.
In this such a conference, parallel to what we see all around the world, the demonstrations of millions of the people who are arising, we have not seen throughout the history that 300,000, 400,000 people come in London and support the Palestinians, more than a million people in the United States. So what we believe that if we held such a conferences in different countries, which is the first one in Iran, we can put some sorts of pressures on the governments that they also make a move to try to solve an end to this catastrophe which is happening in Gaza.
So far, a substantial amount of humanitarian aid, including medicine, food, and tents weighing 10,000 tons, has been provided by Iran and is ready to be dispatched to Gaza.
Setting up an international fund and also establishing routes into Gaza to assist the civilians in need are among the most important decisions made during this conference. Gizum Shahmari, Tehran.
And the recent report reveals a dramatic 43% decline in Kuwait's petrol exports to Europe, primarily attributed to the ongoing situation in the Red Sea, which has recently been a scene of clashes between American and Yemeni forces. Our Kuwait correspondent has a report.
Kuwait, a key player in the global oil market, has recently experienced a significant setback in its petrol exports to Europe with a staggering 43% decline, according to a recent S&P report. This decrease is mainly caused by escalating pressure on ship owners to steer clear of the Red Sea, which has seen an exchange of fire between American and Yemeni forces in recent days. The situation escalated after the US-UK alliance airstrikes on Yemen earlier this month. The two countries claim they acted to protect international shipping from Yemeni attacks. This is while attacks by Yemenis are only aimed at Israeli vessels or vessels moving toward the Israeli-occupied territories. They say this is a targeted effort to apply pressure on Israel to move towards an urgent ceasefire in Gaza.
The attack of Yemeni fighters on Israeli ships is a natural reaction to pressure countries that support Israel to stop their support, while also demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. If the attack on Yemen continues, the resistance will continue to respond, and this could get bigger.
This situation has especially hurt Europe significantly, impacting its imports of refined petroleum products in the first half of January. European supply chains are already strained, experiencing delays, increased shipping costs, and potential financial losses for businesses dependent on the Red Sea route. It appears that Europe's steadfast support for Israel has had severe repercussions for the continent itself.
The Yemeni fighters target only Israeli vessels and those which are going to Israel. The alternative is taking another route from Ras Raja Saleh. This transfer takes 15 days or more with higher costs. These factors in the short run will cause inflation. Economists warn of a domino effect that could eventually hit European consumers harder than the inflation of 2022 during the Russia-Ukraine conflict. They warn Europe may face higher energy costs and delayed shipments, leading to an economic crisis.
Europe finds itself in a precarious position as it appears to be embarking on a military involvement in the situation in the region, risking its vested interests in the Persian Gulf region and its trade connections. In the meantime, the Yemeni resistance fighters are being widely hailed across Muslim countries for adopting effective strategies to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza.
As the world continues to monitor these developments in the Red Sea, the Yemeni resistance fighters continue to fight to pressure Israel for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City.
Thank you for being with us. Take care for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM, 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
As global outrage continues to simmer over the slaughter of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip by the settler colonial Zionist regime, it is necessary to look back at the history of Africa, where the first genocide of the 20th century took place. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, though a span of 120 years separates the tragic events across two continents, from Palestine to Namibia, the horror of premeditated genocides evokes unequal pain and suffering for victims. Historians record that in 1904, the Herero and Nama people of Namibia, then known as German Southwest Africa, rose against the German colonizers in their struggle for freedom. The war launched by Germany against Herero and Nama, and the infamous extermination order issued by German General Lothar von Trotha that followed to crush the indigenous population, is considered by most historians to be the first genocide of the 20th century. Within the German borders, every male Herero, armed or unarmed, will be shot to death. I will no longer take in women or children, but will drive them back to their people or have them fired at. These are my words to the Herero people, from the great general of the mighty German Kaiser. Various sources confirm that in the ensuing 4 years, from 1904, tens of thousands of men, women and children were shot, tortured or driven into the Kalahari Desert to starve by German troops. It is against this backdrop that many commentators have been shocked to learn of the German government's decision to back the Benjamin Netanyahu regime over the genocide case brought by South Africa against the child killer regime of Israel at the International Court of Justice recently, Germany has declared that it will oppose South Africa's application by casting its lot behind the Zionist regime. German government spokesperson Stefan Heberscheidt said in a statement, "German government firmly and explicitly rejects the accusation of genocide that has now been made against Israel before the International Court of Justice. This accusation has no basis whatsoever." He stressed that Germany bears a special responsibility for the Zionist regime due to the Nazi genocide during the Second World War, and said the government will continue to support the fabricated regime of Israel to defend itself against resistance groups. He said, in view of Germany's history, crimes against humanity, and Shoah, the government is particularly committed to the UN Genocide Convention, adding, the German government supports the International Court of Justice in its work, as it has done for many decades. The government intends to intervene as a third party in the main hearing. However, this bizarre move has sparked controversy, and rightly so. President of Namibia, Dr. Hage G. Geingob, issued a strong statement of condemnation rejecting Germany's support of the genocidal intent of the racist Israeli regime against people in Gaza. He reminded Germany that on Namibian soil, it committed the first genocide in which tens of thousands of innocent Namibians died in the most inhumane and brutal conditions, he said. The German government is yet to fully atone for the genocide it committed on the Namibian soil. In his statement, President Geingob criticized Germany's inability to draw lessons from its horrific history in Namibia. He further expressed deep concern with the shocking decision communicated by Germany, in which it rejected the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Criminal Court, that the Zionist regime is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. He noted, worryingly, ignoring the violent deaths of over 23,000 Palestinians in Gaza and various United Nations reports disturbingly highlighting the internal displacement of 85% of civilians in Gaza amid acute shortages of food and essential services, the German government has chosen to defend in the International Criminal Court the genocidal and gruesome acts of Israel against innocent civilians in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territories. The Namibian leader correctly asserted that Germany cannot morally express commitment to the United Nations Convention Against Genocide, including atonement for the genocide in Namibia, while supporting the equivalent of genocide in Gaza. Many human rights watchdogs have chillingly concluded that the Zionist regime is committing war crimes in Gaza. President Geingob reiterated his call made on December 31st, 2023, that no peace-loving human being can ignore the carnage waged against Palestinians in Gaza. Not surprising, thus, that the Palestinian resistance group Hamas has noted with alarm these developments, which it claims must not be at Palestine's expense. The Gaza-based movement said, "We expected that Germany had learned a lesson from its recent history, as it committed genocide more than once in the last century, the first of which was against the population of Namibia at the beginning of the last century. It is not permissible under any circumstances for Germany to attempt to correct its sins at the expense of our people and by defending the criminals who commit the crime of genocide and ethnic cleansing against our Palestinian people." Both Namibia and Hamas have called on the German government to immediately retract its decision and to stand by the Palestinian victims and their legitimate rights to freedom, independence, and the right to self-determination. So far, Germany and other Zionist allies in the West stand on the wrong side of history.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Hi, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Hali Saravi, your host at The Viewpoint. Here in the studio, I'm accompanied by Brother Ali from the Islamic Seminary of Qom and also Sheikh Rouhani. He's a scholar and a researcher at universities in Qom. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So, the first item we're going to talk about is about this phenomenon that we're experiencing these days in the society, the matter of hopelessness. Teenagers, especially families, are experiencing these problems in the society. Let's get to the cause of it. Any ideas, any thoughts? Let's start from Brother Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Emotions or sensations are an important part of human nature, and most of the time they appear involuntary in person. I mean, we experience many positive or negative emotions throughout our lives. Disappointment is one of these feelings that usually happens to us or captures us. Usually it happens due to these situations or status that we are powerless and we have nothing to do. We are unable to achieve the goals that we have defined for ourselves. So those who are afflicted with this hopelessness or I can say despair usually are after something, and they feel that they were unable to. They were after something, and they feel that they were unable to achieve that goal. So they feel a sort of backwardness towards whatever happened in their life. So this is one kind of look to this issue. That is, we think that we are not that useful for the society, for the family, for the community that we are in, or we feel that, we cannot find any glimpse of hope into the prosperity or salvation, whether we are going to look at it materially or spiritually. So we think that we are not that useful. So this sense, if it is going to be aggravated and to be strengthened, it is a bit dangerous, and it might cause some danger to the structure of the person, and even at the end of the day might lead to committing a suicide, which is very dangerous. But this is one kind of look at this issue, which is a common psychological kind of look at this. But at the same time, if we refer to the Islamic resources and Islamic texts, we see that this can happen due to the mistakes or sometimes the sins that we have already committed. So, God forbid, we got accustomed to some bad actions and we repeated them, and day in and day out, we never tried to leave them. Living those mistakes and sins. It creates a sense of hopelessness in our personality and in our worldview. So what are the ways to get rid of these things is an issue.
Okay,
that
so we're going to talk about it later.
Sure.
I just want to pose this question to Sheikh Rouhani. What do you think? What is it that you believe? Is it more internal, the sources of hopelessness, or external? Does it come from within or from outside? Any ideas?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, I want to shed light on this point from the Islamic perspective based on the riwayat and hadith as well as the ayat of the Holy Quran. That what are those things that cause the hopelessness in a person? Of course, hope is something internal, or it is something related to the internal affairs of our life, because the one who is hopeful, so of course he has some beautiful kind of dreams, objectives, purposes in his life, and of course he relies on, for example, very trustworthy kind of sources. He, for example, firmly believes in, for example, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the God's graces. That's why he became actually hopeful. Hope is not something that be given to the people from outside. It should be within our mind. It should be, of course, something eternal, because it's like idea. Idea is always inside us, not outside. That is why if the one is of a firm belief in something, if the one is very much, or his life is or her life is very much purposeful, and he has, for example, beautiful, let's say, ideas, dreams, let's say, objectives, purposes in his life. So, of course, in that case, that person could be a kind of hopeful person seeking the knowledge, seeking or fulfilling their dreams, trying to attain or achieve their objectives of life. These are the things that can give us hope and life. But beyond that, there is the presence of our Lord in our life. If the one lives in the presence of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he believes firmly that there is God and God is always observing him, and actually he is caring about him, providing him with all the things that he needs, with sustenance. All these things can give a better hope for a person who is faithful. So the one who is faithless, without iman, without faith, of course, this kind of person always are hopeless, because hope is, it means that you rely on something, you trust on something. So that thing that you trust on, that thing that you rely on, that should be like absolutely powerful, that should be absolutely perfect, that should be the absolute source of beauty, source of pleasure, source of, let's say, hope. Otherwise, you cannot live hopefully in this world while there are lots of hardships, difficulties, challenges, shortcomings that we face in our life. So each one of these things every day can make us hopeless. But if someone believes firmly in Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that he is there, he is caring, and he is actually managing and controlling each and everything in this universe, and the whole universe is purposeful, the creation of the universe is purposeful, and man's creation is purposeful, and that is the ultimate kind of pleasure, ultimate kind of beauty that one can attain at the end of the day. So this kind of life would be full of hope. Otherwise, of course, being hopeful and living hopefully is really difficult in this material world in which we face and we suffer lots of shortcomings and lots of, let's say, hardships.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. But, you know, there is a question here. I think this is the question of many, many of our audiences or listeners. You know, in a world full of calamities, full of difficulties and hardships, it's really hard to find hope. I mean, we are living there are wars, different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. We see people killing each other. You know, so many calamities, as I said earlier. So, isn't it hard for people to find hope? But don't you think?
Well, it depends on the kind of look that we have at the life and our worldview. We see this world as an opportunity for ourselves to, or let's say, a scene of test, because we believe that this short life is a sort of test for us to prepare ourselves for the other, for the next world, for the other life. We have seen these calamities and, let's say, difficulties that you're talking about are not something new. They have been with human beings from day one of the creation. I mean, they are not quite new. So let's see how people actually tackled and behaved such calamities. We have different kinds of people that we can study. We have some people from the elites of the society, and we have some commonly and ordinary people. But who are our role models? It depends that who are going to be our role models. We have, for example, the life of Prophet Yunus alayhi salam. You see, his life was full of hardships.
Very difficult.
And Prophet Ayub, alayhi salam, so how did he live? And how he treated and how he tackled this difficulty that it lasted almost for 200 years of illness. It's not something easy. I mean, saying it is easy, but tolerating it for a couple of days would be really serious. So we see that what we have been asked to be patient like them and to see the whole world beautiful rather than dreadful. So this kind of look, thinking positively, actually changes your worldview. So as much as we are positive, we can make the environment around us, the whole world, the universe beautiful and prosperous. So it depends, as I said, in our kind of look towards the universe and the worldview that we have. So being positive, like the religious authorities, like the leaders of the human beings in the course of history, actually gives us this glad tiding that, okay, so there is a chance. There is a chance for us that even in these calamities, we see nothing except beauty. Like what Lady Zainab Salamallahu Alaihi said after martyrdom of 18 people from her family, her own children. She said, "Oma ra'aytu illa jamila." You see, I haven't seen except beauty.
So it seems it's. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. It seems like it's a journey, isn't it? It's definitely like a life experience.
Definitely, we are in this journey, and this journey is meaningful for us. I mean, suppose that you are taking this journey, and the way that you look at this journey makes it beautiful or dreadful. Suppose that you are going to the north of this country, I mean, in summer, while the weather is highly humid.
No.
But you might say that, okay, so the weather is that bad, it can be tolerated, but at the same time, you see some people from your own relatives, and you enjoy your stay there, you enjoy the beauty, the green scenery of that. Then these are the things that make it more beautiful, not that negative aspect of it.
So can I say the way you interpret the world?
Definitely, yeah. This is
how you see the world and your worldview.
In a monotheistic worldview, in a Tawhidi worldview, we welcome everything from the side of God as beauty. Even the martyrdom that in the eyes of some is very dreadful and very difficult and very bad, in the eyes of a believer is very sweet, you see. That's why the companions of Imam Hussein al-Islam, they were competing to be martyred and to defend the goal and the idea that they have been fighting for, you see. So this worldview changes everything. So you think that whatever comes to you is beautiful.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much. Well done. That was great. I hope we could talk more and more about this issue. I hope in the future we can have more time to discuss these ideas and these subjects.
Inshallah.
Thank you for coming. It's time to wrap up today's episode. Thank you all for listening. May the mighty Allah bless you all.
يقولها شفاعة أنا لها
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
A new investigation has revealed that black people applying to police forces across England and Wales under a government recruitment drive had a significantly higher rejection rate than their white counterparts. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The leader of Britain's police chiefs organisation, Gavin Stevens, has become the most senior serving leader to say that policing is institutionally racist, as he called for a fundamental redesign of national policies and practices to eliminate discrimination. Gavin Stevens, the chair of the National Police Chiefs Council, said black people should no longer experience disproportionate use of force, and that too little progress had been made to reform policing, with some leaders slow to accept the size of the challenge. Gavin Stevens, elected by his fellow chief constables to lead their representative body, emphasized it was his personal view that discrimination in policing operated at an institutional level. In an interview with The Guardian, he said, "It's a leadership responsibility for us to describe to them what institutional racism means and what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that all police officers are racist." He added, "The way our policies, procedures and training have been designed and implemented for many years have not had the voices of black people involved in the design, in the implementation of those practices. And as a consequence of that, we get disproportionate outcomes in places where there shouldn't be disproportionate outcomes." He added, "The most helpful discussion for policing to have in the future is how we redesign the policies, the practices, the implementation of policing to remove that discrimination." Gavin Stevens' remarks come as policing continues to wrestle with the issue of whether it should accept it suffers from institutional discrimination, a debate dating back more than 30 years. His intervention will add to pressure on the heads of England's biggest police forces to adopt the idea, including the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Mark Rowley. Rowley refused to accept the terms institutionally racist and institutionally misogynistic after a damning report last year, with the Metropolitan Police Commissioner claiming their meanings were unclear. Those findings by Louise Casey in March after the murder of Sarah Everard in 2021 were contained in the second report to find police to be institutionally racist. The first report by William McPherson in 1999 followed an inquiry into failings that allowed the racist killers of Stephen Lawrence to escape justice. Police leaders accepted the findings of the report, then later claimed to have reformed the service to the extent that it no longer applied. Gavin Stevens said his personal view was that the reports were correct. He said, "The problems that we need to solve across policing are at institutional level, and they need institutional changes." Whether you look at the McPherson definition in the Stephen Lawrence report, or whether you look at Louise Casey's definition, my personal view is that they apply to policing. As for clarity on whether his personal view was that police are institutionally racist, Gavin Stevens replied, "Yes," while emphasizing that his reasoning for reaching that conclusion was important. Police chiefs debated whether to admit to institutional racism in 2022, with most being against making the admission. Police in Scotland, the second biggest force in the United Kingdom, as well as Avon and Somerset Police and the British Transport Police, have accepted that the term applies to them. But the biggest three forces in England, the Metropolitan Police, the West Midlands Police Force, and the Greater Manchester Police, all disagree. Gavin Stevens said, "Colleagues have valid reasons why they don't want to go down that route. After the murder of George Floyd in the United States and the subsequent Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, the NPCC promised reform and launched a race action plan, which critics say has done little or nothing after 3 years. Gavin Stevens said progress had been made, but that some of his fellow police chiefs had been slow to accept the scale of the problem. He said, "We have got some tangible results. I'd be the first to accept that we haven't made progress at the rate that we would have wanted to. To get acceptance of the scale of that challenge took longer than we had anticipated." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Gavin Stevens, the chair of the National Police Chiefs Council, NPCC, said he personally supported the idea of police officers being licensed in the same way that nurses or doctors were. He believed it would help professionalise the police service and hoped for an active debate among his fellow police chiefs. The scale of the racial disparity in the use of force in England and Wales was laid out by police leaders in 2022 when they launched the first written version of their race plan. They wrote, "Black people are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people and 5 times more likely to be subjected to the use of force. 10% of our recorded searches, 27% of use of force incidents, and 35% of taser incidents involve someone from a black ethnic group." The latest estimate suggests that only 3.5% of the population is black. Some have said that police stereotype black men as being more dangerous. Gavin Stevens, who grew up in Hartlepool, said this was wrong. This myth that sometimes exists in popular culture that young black men are dangerous, it's a myth. Yes, young black men get involved in crime. Yes, they're at risk of victimization, but so do white men, if you go to my neck of the woods. He added, "If you've got that cultural connection, if you've got something in common with the person that you're dealing with on the street, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to be able to resolve that issue without resorting to the use of force." Meanwhile, a new investigation revealed that black people applying to police forces across England and Wales under a government recruitment drive had a significantly higher rejection rate than their white counterparts. An investigation by the MediaStorm podcast acquired the data through Freedom of Information responses from 32 out of the 43 police forces in England and Wales. In total, they reflected 181,175 applicants. In 2019, then Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to recruit 20,000 more police officers. And in April of this year, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced the target had been hit. Analysis by reporters for the podcast and Pete Jones, a psychologist who has consulted UK police forces on implicit bias in recruitment, found that black applicants to the uplift drive had a pass rate of 7.3%, compared with 18.72% for white candidates. Asian applicants had a pass rate of 9.18%, and mixed-race candidates had a pass rate of 14.38%. The team compared the number of applicants with the number of appointments to calculate the pass rate for each group, as well as their adverse impact ratios. Jones said, "Police uplift was a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the police service to be representative of the communities that it serves, and it has squandered it." Jones added, "We can keep on pointing fingers at communities, but at some point we have to turn the mirror on ourselves and say, well, perhaps it's our system that have done this." All 43 police forces in England and Wales were sent Freedom of Information requests. 34 of them responded. 2, Nottinghamshire and Wiltshire, said the information was not stored in a way to permit easy retrieval. And remaining 9 police forces failed to respond within the statutory timescale.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.